There's no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Ladies and gentlemen, are we ready to go?
Yeah.
We're good. Ladies and gentlemen, before we begin today's episode, what I need from you is to loosen that belt buckle. All right, number one, because we're about to get a little bit freaky, and this is a no-pants zone, right, Marcus?
Yo, man, I'm down with you.
Kissel, keep your pants on, please.
I'm going to keep my pants on.
I actually would actually really appreciate it, but that's also at the same time, spiritually imagine no pants.
All right, I can do that.
So.
It's cold, man.
It is a little cold. It's chilly in L.A., but guys, remember, if you want to fucking understand that Jack Parsons vibe, then you need to become one with the sorcerer's marimba. Hit up that Thelema jazz music, man.
All right.
Because this is good, dude. Layer it in.
Oh, this is the music they would have sex to?
Dude, sousaphone.
It's not a sousaphone. A sousaphone's a tuba.
Just quit it. He doesn't know.
Sounds like a, instead of a snake charmer, something a gerbil charmer would listen
dude,
to.
Dude, it's a lady charmer, dog. Because you can't see, man. You got one skinny guy with that long hair, and he's in front of his robe open, just saying, come to me. Come to me, lady of Babylon.
Right,
whoa!
Right.
And then you just got that lithe other woman who's just in from out of town, and she doesn't know that she's going to be the subject to a moon child like ceremony. She doesn't know. She literally is just visiting SoCal.
This sounds like it could trigger someone's Crohn's disease.
Dude, this is Crohn's disease. Old Crone, the witch within the hut. Respect her.
All right, welcome to Last Podcast on the Left, everyone. I am Ben, hanging out with Marcus.
Gets me in the fucking groove.
And now Jazzy, Henry Zabrowski. That gets me in the mood to have a five-car pileup. I don't know what mood I'm supposed to be in, but I'm in it.
You need to spend some time alone with it.
Yeah, it's Graham Bond. The album's called Holy Magic. It's really fucking cool. It reminds me of Moondog.
Yeah,
it's
some
cool shit.
Right.
I mean, it is actually legitimately good. It's a legitimately good album. That album goes for like $100 on Discogs.
Take it from Marcus. He also has a record that is just the sounds of planes taking off and landing.
Because, again.
It's called X-15 Experimental Sounds.
I know.
What Crowley teaches us at the very top, right, is that we got to strip down all these layers of meaning to get down to the cum. And that's what he's talking about, is the cum of Discog. That's what this is. It is. It fills the cup with its practitioner seed.
That does sound. It does sound like a record needle just combing through cum. As a matter of fact. All right, everyone.
You're gonna love this episode.
I can't wait. We are on to Jack Parsons, part three.
So when we last left Jack Parsons, he'd sold his shares in the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. The JPL, if you'll remember, was the company Parsons helped found with the Suicide Squad. And eventually, that company would manufacture everything from the lunar and Mars landers to the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft.
Yeah, wow. Man. I actually did see a TikTok recently. It was pretty compelling, basically saying the Challenger explosion never happened.
What do you mean it never happened?
Do your own research.
Tell it to that teacher.
No. She's safe and alive.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It was a series of pictures of the people that were inside of the Challenger shuttle, right? And it showed them now what they are now because they were all, their deaths were faked, right? Because it was done to try to proffer more funds into the NASA space program, which worked.
The exact, what?
No, it
I don't
worked.
No, I don't think it did.
I think it completely destroyed the public's faith in the space shuttle.
That's why we have a private contract with Tesla.
Cui bono. Cui bono, Tesla. Okay. No, it's fake. It's not real. They all died tragically.
Awesome.
Well, while it wouldn't necessarily be fair to say that Jack Parsons was throwing away his professional career because he did later attempt to return to rocketry, he was certainly taking a big risk in getting out of the rocket game just when it was finally being taken seriously. Although I think that was part of the reason why he got out.
Did he have a gambling addiction? Was his father shot on the side of the road?
Whoa, Michael Jordan. It was a distraction for him in the finals. This is something different because I do believe that Jack Parsons, he had a stripe in him that was a pacifist.
Mm-hmm.
And we joke a little bit, like I think last time, about kind of like, you know, it kind of came up, like, did he care or not? And it seemed he had a sort of laissez-faire attitude about the munitions world for a period of time, as he did about everything. But then for a while, I think he was getting bummed out that his work was getting used to blow people up.
Yeah.
Right.
And for a while, he was, it did seem like he was like into the science part of it, and he could ignore the social aspect of where it all went to. But according to his own writings, he did not enjoy basically helping what he called his so-called slavery mindset of the working class by helping us all into this giant military industrial complex that he was an intrinsic part of.
Yeah.
And the thing is, he wasn't the only one that was bummed out. Like, the atomic bomb really fucked with a lot of rocket scientists' heads.
Very much
so. I believe
it,
man. Yeah, because they're aiding and abetting the destruction of all mankind.
Yeah.
That would, like, be like, oh, what a day.
Yeah, like, you know?
Man, like, if you work at, like, McDonald's, you'd be like, I didn't get that Big Mac out on time, and I got a milkshake thrown at me. But, like, the other one is just like, everyone's dead.
Everyone's vaporized.
Wow.
But the risk was especially large because Jack was putting the brakes on a highly profitable career so he could switch his focus completely to magic. And of course, live the groovy lifestyle that went along with the practice.
Oh, Dad, yeah. I'm dropping out of med school. I'm going to be a comedian.
Fuck! Most of the time dads get mad is because they're jealous. Because they wanted to be a comedian. Because it's like my father was a little bit like that.
So when you say most of the time, you're talking specifically about you and your father.
I am me. I am you. We are all we. But together, we are us.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll get you, man. I watched a lot of LRH this week.
You got me.
So by 1945, the mansion Jack Parsons owned in Pasadena, affectionately known as the Parsonage, was home to about 20 bohemians, woo, occultists, and scientists.
Eat bush, man. Fucking licking ass. Man, having a good time. A lot of incense.
I mean, these guys were all living especially unconventional lives, considering how this was post-World War II America. This is 1945.
Okay. In Sex and Rockets, I actually got a really interesting take on that, was that they thought that after World War II, everybody, there was like an undercurrent of, maybe I'm wrong, but it was an interesting take. There's an undercurrent of like, everyone was super horny. Because
I believe
the boys
it, man.
Were over in the war, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They were only sucking each other's penises. And up for a while, that gets boring yeah. because they're bad at it.
Yeah,
you know
of
what I mean?
Course.
Private Gregson, his heart's not in it. He's just stuck in Italy.
Yeah he's scared.
But also the women were super horny because the men were all gone. And they, again,
they were all working.
Some of them, especially yeah. Waves, which we'll get into more so, unfortunately, next episode, but you'll see. It's worth it.
We're getting into it on this episode.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, yeah.
I think post-war sex is probably the greatest sex you can have. You both survive. You're both massively traumatized.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I bet you can have some incredible orgasms.
I think that's where all of this came from. It was a bunch of gush-needing people that, like, you know, they all were working in various...
None of these people were in combat.
No,
of them, sir.
But it's like
but when you
were,
hear it, when you hear it, though,
yeah.
like when I survived Iraq War I in 93 and Iraq War II yeah. from 2003 to 2020,
we as a people
yeah.
were in that war for 20 years. All right.
Yeah.
I watched Bush get. Oh, Kanye read him to filth back in the day. And I remember that war.
All right. So first of all, his life's weird. In addition, Wilford Smith, the man Aleister Crowley had tried to trick into tattooing 666 on his forehead, yes. that guy had returned to the parsonage with Jack's first wife, Helen. Because remember, they both ran off together. And after Jack and Helen officially got divorced, Wilford Smith and Helen moved back into the parsonage.
This is this whole polyamory like world where everybody's cool with everybody. And it does take a lot of work. But we see Jack Parsons did begin to struggle.
It's really difficult to turn away from human nature in that sense.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Well, that is all to say, Jack Parsons was in a weird, vulnerable, transitory place in 1945. And it was during this emotional state that Parsons began practicing magic with one of the worst people in history to be around.
Here we go.
If you're feeling vulnerable.
We got to have some kind of intro music. We have to have that, like what they used to do for Don Rickles.
Oh, yeah. Can we get the gong from The Undertaker?
Yeah.
That person was L. Ron Hubbard, founder of the Church of Scientology.
Now, if you remember from our L. Ron Hubbard series, we did cover this relationship from his kind of perspective, which was that Jack Parsons was another speed bump on his way to true herodom and godlike status, right? That Jack Parsons was just a dude he sucked up and spit out.
Yeah.
Right.
But now we're seeing how Jack was affected and what it's like when you meet a young, you know, imagine what it was like when you met me for the first time.
I remember that.
You meet this dynamic, kind of like, who's that sexy? He's obviously full of sex. All he does is fucking write and think and amaze. Uh-huh. He's a story spinner. Everybody's jealous of his style.
Right.
Yeah, sure, he was a fucking war hero in name only, but guess what? That's the best way to be, because then you don't have all those sad, real stories after the fact all the baggage.
Yeah, like you made up all the sketches and stuff like that.
Just like that.
Yeah.
Now, in 1945, L. Ron Hubbard was just another science fiction writer spending time in Los Angeles. He was mostly living off the disability he'd scammed from the government following his ignoble career in the Navy.
Science fiction!
Yeah.
But L. Ron was actually doing fairly well in the sci-fi game, because he'd moved on from Westerns with oddly homoerotic names like Ride 'em Cowboy.
Sure, that's just what they do.
I remember that.
Buckskin Brigade.
I remember that.
That's just a group of leather-clad boys that are hard-dusted from the road, and yeah, they're a bit thirsty for each other. When it comes down to it, it's hard when you only have horses for company.
Well, do you want your garage built or not? You gotta call them.
And do you remember... Hot lead payoff.
I actually don't remember that one.
I remember goo payoff.
Yeah.
Well, L. Ron was a member of the Los Angeles Science Fantasy Society, which is a group of sci-fi writers who regularly gathered for meetings at the cafeteria we mentioned last episode. And these meetings were also regularly attended by Jack Parsons. See, Parsons was certainly a big sci-fi fan, and he was what you'd call a good hang to boot.
Everybody said vibes were immaculate. When you hung out with Jack Parsons, you were going to have a good time, because he wasn't a bummer to be around. He was a fun guy. He was like that. And it just so happened to be hot people kind of attached themselves to him.
Ooh, yeah. It's like us.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. So I think it's fun that you're putting L. Ron Hubbard in the hot people category.
Well, hey, according to Henry, you can just see the cooks before these nerds come in being like, did you make the extra jello or not? Because if they don't get their jello, they only eat food they can manipulate.
And Jack, he loved to...
I need a food that's between states. I'm Robert Heinlein. And he's honestly a difficult man. Yeah. Robert Heinlein was a very...
Yeah. They're all difficult men. Yeah, is Isaac Asimov like a good hang? No.
I don't think so.
He was a miserable fuck.
He just seemed like he was really thinking about the future, when sometimes you need to think about the present.
That's absolutely right.
Well, Jack loved attending these meetings because the writers took Jack seriously, and Jack was loved in turn because he was one of the few scientists who saw sci-fi as a source of inspiration. All the rest of them looked at it as kid stuff.
Yeah.
Now, as far as Jack Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard went, it's hard to say who was attracted to who first, or if Hubbard immediately saw Parsons as a mark who could be sucked dry of all his knowledge and money.
I'll posit a little bit of Occam's razor here. Mm. I think that he needed a place to stay and that he was running scams all over town and with the government. And then he got an opportunity to stay at Jack Parsons' house. And I do think that, again, Jack Parsons saw him and was like, this guy's funny. I do think there's a little bit of that. And everybody else, we waver. We waver between L. Ron, right? Is he full of shit?
Do we?
Well, I mean...
I think you're the only oscillating fan in this one.
Because I appreciate his tactics. Yeah. I appreciate his energy, his style.
Seems like he's caused a lot of...
I want the boat!
Caused a lot of harm in some ways.
Nowadays. Yeah. Because David Miscavige actually did it poorly. But we'll get into that when we do the David Miscavige episodes later on.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. But I feel like there's a little bit of... The thing about magicians... Especially Jack Parsons' ilk. I think that you can see that this guy's full of shit, but you could also be like, this guy's hilarious. And that there's a little bit of that. We're like, this is a fun guy to have in the room.
Yeah. Well, what they said about L. Ron Hubbard at the time is that when you met him, you were either immediately repulsed.
Sure.
Or, which was a word they used a lot relation to L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah.
Some people don't like peanut butter. I'm looking at you, UK.
Absolutely. They do like peanut butter in the UK.
Yeah, they learned.
Yeah. Hey, we forced it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You were either repulsed or you quickly fell under his charm. And Parsons, of course, was charmed, saying that he recognized Hubbard immediately as a man possessing great magical skill, which is a statement I wholeheartedly agree with.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. He was a very charming man. I mean, again, you're amongst it.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not talking about the charming. I don't think he was a charming man, but he was a fantastic. He did have a fantastic magical mind.
Oh, yes. Because again, anybody who can make up your entire past, which is what every single one of the great magicians of all history have ever done, which is you get rid of all that boring shit. Helena, I was in Montana, blah. You get rid of all that shit and you pave it all over with what your version of history is. And yes, some people call it lying.
Yeah.
But some people also call it world building.
Okay.
In addition, L. Ron Hubbard was the only sci-fi writer at these meetings who had also studied the works of Aleister Crowley, and he already had a deep understanding of the material in the same way Parsons did. Basically, it's like finding someone who likes your favorite band just as much as you do, and for all the same reasons.
Oh my God, you like the Glorp brothers too? I can't believe it. They're so incredible. Their song, Going Glorpin', Glorpin' all the time.
Off the album, Going Glorpin'.
I know.
The difference, though, was that while Parsons was a true believer who just wanted to make something happen, Hubbard was more cynical and looked at magic as just another resource to extract and use no matter the consequence. Put another way, Parsons used magic like you might use solar power. L. Ron Hubbard used it more like fracking.
It's because gas is clean. LRH.
I mean, it is kind of fun being like, what police department's going to sink next? Do you think it'll be like an elementary school go back to the earth?
We'll find out.
That's just kind of fun about fracking.
Yeah, it is. You never know when something's going to be a sinkhole.
Yeah.
But he's... I feel like it was a gradual process in a way. We'll go as we go through their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I think that on LRH's behalf, because he was already cooking up Excalibur. You remember he had all his the book that would kill you?
Yeah.
Like the book that he would say, like, oh, you can't see my secret manuscript. So he was already kind of like in that world and mm-hmm. wanting to be in that world. And it wasn't until like he saw the actual paperwork of the OTO.
Yeah.
Where he was just like, there's my shit. Like, it's like he finally kind of saw like little pieces.
At this time, had he already done the affirmations?
No, the affirmations. Well, I want to get to that because it's after all of this.
Okay.
I'm just happy that L. Ron Hubbard didn't do what People magazine did when they were like the man of the year or person of the year, and it was just a fake mirror because we were all the person of the year.
Makes me
because I could totally see him thinking like, what if the end, it's not Xenu, it's you.
But that's Kissel.
Yeah.
You fucking asshole, correct.
Nice.
You again stumbled into magical knowledge,
yeah, God damn
which
it.
Is the whole thing. That's the nth level. Like, we'll again, I want to talk about it more, but like Crowley kind of like hints at this whole thing at the very, I'm going to wait.
Yeah, wow. You basically just said you are your own God.
Yeah.
But that's the thing is that it takes you a long time to understand what it means to be your own God.
It takes a lot of money that you have to give to L. Ron Hubbard.
But no, this is the difference between Scientology and ritual magic, where Scientology is a never-ending source of psychological and spiritual DLCs, where the fucking magic, like all the magic world, it's supposed to release you up and out.
Yeah.
Like it is, you're supposed to end it. Knowing at the very end, we'll get it. Well,
All right, your brain's about to explode.
Now, when Hubbard moved into the Parsons mansion in 1945, he was only 3 years older than Jack. And true to form, everyone in the house was either repulsed or charmed by good old Ron. Parsons, of course.
He just looks like you.
That's it. That's the only thing you share in common.
I'm just so happy you don't look like Adolf Hitler.
Horrible haircut.
Yes.
That's my main gripe.
Truly.
Parsons, of course, wanted everyone to like Hubbard. And he even wrote gushing letters of praise about his new friend. Here's an excerpt from one of those letters.
He is a gentleman. Red hair, green eyes, honest and intelligent. And we have become great friends. Although he has no formal training in magic, he has an extraordinary amount of experience and understanding in the field. He is the most thelemic person I have ever met. And I have eaten my own cum.
Wow.
And is in complete accord with our own principles.
All right. Well, there you go. He's thelemic. Don't cut him. He'll bleed forever.
Yeah. Funny.
There we
funny
go.
Stuff, Kissel.
Now, what does he mean by he's the most thelemic person he's ever met?
All right. Well, let's unpack it for a little bit. Because on some level, I love our thelemites. All right, no judgment, right? Love our Thelemites.
Sure.
You guys are an intense bunch, right?
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to get together in a group because each one of you is a star and I think that's great. But it also tends, you guys all fight literally constantly about what everything means, which is an important aspect of Crowley's work.
Like, sure.
You're supposed to adjudicate it, right? But what he means by thelemic, I think, is that when he met this dude straight up, one of the great barriers to magical ritual, like, and this is just the truth, is that you have to be able to have a certain amount of patience with looking like a moron
yeah.
while doing it. You got to put a hat on. You got to wear a robe. You got to do the like, Io, son of Gabriel. You got to do these like hand motions. You got to do all of this shit. And that's actually pretty much the major barrier to entry at the very, very top. That's how you know whether or not you're a quote unquote neophyte or not, is if you are naturally inclined to be into the material. There are people that are just not into it, obviously, because the whole point is that it's supposed to look kind of like dumb and crazy and labyrinthian. Like, why would I want to be with all these people jerking off into a cup? Look at your face.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're an air traffic controller for a bunch of, you know.
Morons. Yeah. A bunch of but horny nerds, right? But when he met LRH, he was just like, I don't need to massage this guy at all.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to because there was a little bit of Jack Parsons. What Crowley liked about Parsons in the Agape Lounge is that he's like, all right, maybe this guy's going to make us cool again in a way. Like, he's going to kind of put us on the map.
And the money.
Yes, obviously. But a lot of it's also like, he runs in these cool circles. He's in the science world. He's got these like actors and performers and all this shit. And like, maybe he'll like help make us kind of cool. He'll like bump us up.
Yeah, he hangs out with sci-fi writers. He's going to be the coolest guy around.
He's a really magician. Cool. Magicians are at the time at the bottom rung of what anybody remotely thinks is interesting.
Right.
Right. It's still to this day that holds.
Maybe not the bottom rung any longer.
It's close. Yeah, it's closer.
Penn and Teller, people like them.
But LRH shows up and he doesn't need all the trappings. Like Jack Parsons would kind of sell people on kind of like the group sex aspect and like kind of the kind of bohemian atmosphere that's happening in this house, where LRH, while immediately he acted as if he wasn't, but he definitely was way into how much snooch he could booch, right?
Yeah.
He wanted it all because, again, I understand. But he didn't need to be buttered up. He was immediately ready. And talk about if there was one person in this life that you could definitely show was acting, quote unquote, according to his own will.
Yeah.
It was LRH, because he simply did not give a fuck about any other singular human being that existed, which is, to me, honestly, a very... what do you put it? It's a very superficial version of Thelema that most people would argue with, which is that why Jack Parsons got trapped, because he was a vulnerable, true student. And then he met a dude, as we said before, who had one foot outside of the circle, feigned interest, played to Jack Parsons' vulnerability, and wormed his way right into the center of the lodge and then tore it apart brick by brick.
So by your logic, the greatest magician of our time, at least in the past 15 years, is Casey Anthony. So you just lie.
It's really important to never, ever once not lie.
Yeah. You can't lie your way out of a search history.
Well, I don't know about that.
What is this strange box? That's how you do it. Is that you hit yourself with a hammer. You're like, what is this? There's a magic box. There's witches in this machine.
What?
It's called Firefox. Look it up.
I know.
Well, before L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons were magical partners, they were first, in essence, two roommates who did weird shit together.
That's how we started this whole show.
Sure. Yeah.
For example, Hubbard and Parsons would fence in the living room with Ed Stranger and a Strange Land author, Robert Heinlein, would join in sometimes as well.
This cool. is jaunty. No, that's, this is like Adam's
that's
family.
Cool.
It
oh,
is.
It's just like Adam's family.
But it was during these fencing sessions that Sarah Northrup, the little sister of Parsons' first wife and Jack Parsons' main squeeze at the time, she started to fall in love with the ruddy, wide-faced redhead tripping over the rugs while he fenced.
He did fall down some, but it was more about his leaps and his parries.
Yes, okay.
During one session in which Sarah was on the edge of her seat with horniness for L. Ron Hubbard for God knows what reason.
You'll sleep on him. I guess, I do understand that my quote-unquote ironic love of LRH has now kind of, it is becoming real, and it's been real for a long time.
Yeah, a really long time,
especially when you put quotes around ironic.
But I feel like that helps me. You know what I mean?
Started calling
that
him LRH.
Helps me from sliding all the way into the hole, right?
Yeah.
But y'all sleep on the tiny, funny, fat little reds. Y'all sleep. Yeah, you talls, you skinnies. Yeah, you're like, you won't fucking, he can't do nothing. He can't steal my girl, right? He can't take my girl, right?
Because
I'm big, right? You never know, because none of you are looking down. All it takes is fucking LRH. He sneaks around the other side. All of a sudden, he's at pussy height.
Right.
Right? So he just has to go, and just like stick his nose into the cleft. And now you're done, y'all, because he already found that clit. He sniff it out.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those where you have to judge the woman. It's like, what? I don't know what's going on.
Well, Parsons noticed that Sarah was paying pretty close attention. So he handed his fencing foil to his girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
And immediately she attacked Hubbard with such fierceness and passion that one spectator thought that she might kill him. Hubbard, however, composed himself and rapped Sarah across the nose with his foil.
Ha ha, got you there.
That was only the beginning of a flirtation that would eventually turn into a relationship.
Wow.
And that relationship would eventually destroy Jack Parsons emotionally and financially.
Fantastic.
Now, of course, OTO doctrine says that romantic jealousy should not be a part of anyone's life.
Ever.
And so you're feeling jealous? Did you not read point number 7?
It's literally what point they number do. Seven. It's the whole point, is yeah. that you're supposed to strip yourselves of these. They're just, these feelings are just so human.
The things that are just like baked in since we were little.
Since base,
we were fucking slugs hanging out in the
attributes.
Ocean. Yeah, okay. Because even penguins get jealous.
Yeah, they commit suicide.
They get pissed.
Yeah. And that no jealousy rule, that went double in a large situation.
Sure.
But there is still a matter of tact when it comes to things like this. And Hubbard pushed Parsons' buttons as much as he possibly could.
I thought you said that this was chill. I thought you said that this was cool. Do you want her back? After I got my slug trail all over?
God, you're so gross.
We're all just clams, baby.
You are disgusting.
Come on.
No, I don't want to.
I was watching that, the only recorded interview with LRH, and you just like... Good Lord, what it must have been like to have been within 5 inches of that mouth. Like, imagine him getting close. I'm like,
yeah, it's a wet mouth.
No, it's the inside of a whale's mouth. Just eating a bunch of raw fish. Although tuna.
I just bite in the side of it.
He does look like the penguin.
He does.
Well, most egregiously, once Sarah and L. Ron Hubbard's sexual relationship began in the house, out in the open...
You know, like they're laughing too hard together, yeah. like I mean, grabbing about, each other's knees.
Instead of being jealous, it's just like you're getting butt juice all over the couch.
Yeah.
Like you just have to not, it's just about being nice. It's just about being.
It's tact.
It's about tact.
Yeah.
We're just roommates here. I'm not jealous. Just like, why am I watching it?
He was jealous.
Okay.
Yeah, he was jealous. Yeah.
He was jealous.
He was getting jealous.
But Ben, I get your point, because Hubbard started making out with Sarah right in front of Jack.
Yeah, baby. And you're like a little, you open up the shell and you see the little foot.
Oh, God.
And he'd do it at dinner. Like, and it, before dinner was like a frivolous affair. Everyone's hanging out with all talking magic.
Sure.
And then it turned, after he started making out, it turned real tense.
Well, that's not about jealousy then. That is. That's we're trying to eat fucking dinner here.
I thought you said that everything's chill and then we share everything together.
You ever bring your Game Boy
to the one who said that we can't be a pure will if we are burdened by all these human feelings.
I mean, my parents bought me a Game Boy when I was a kid, but if I even thought about bringing motocross to fucking dinner, that would be a beating.
Mm-hmm. But even though there were plenty of bad feelings between Parsons and Hubbard personally, Parsons recognized, or perhaps was tricked into thinking, that Hubbard was a valuable ally in his magical pursuits.
But he was doing a very classic thing. He was doing a very classic, like, breaking your personal rules. There's something about in the cult leader. This is, I think, the real difference between a cult leader and whatever Jack Parsons was trying to be as sort of like a lodge captain, right? Mm-hmm. Like the lodge dude in these scenarios in magic ritual worlds, he's supposed to kind of like pass the ball around.
Yeah.
He's like the manager of a rental house.
Sure, yes, kind of. Yes. Well, he's supposed to maintain, but mostly just kind of oversee. And then, yes, he helps decide who pursues up the grades, but for the most part, it's an ongoing conversation.
Think of him as the guy who has his name on the lease.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does. Who does Crowley get mad at? Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody else thinks that, you know, he's the in charge. You know what I mean? But he also gets all the plus the additions. But so I think LRH did this thing where this is where cult leaders really do it, where they step past your personal boundaries and then you say like, thought you said this is cool. Thought you said this is cool. Like, and he's fucking with your boundaries and fucking with your boundaries. And for a while, like, because you're wondering, like, oh, we set up all these rules and I thought that everything was going to be like, you know, like I thought it was going to go one way. And then all of a sudden I'm feeling jealous and he's fucking with me all the time. But then LRH switches all around and be like, and that was the lesson I was trying to teach you all along, is that we need to discard all of these things. I'm helping you in your processes of stripping all of these feelings down.
Yeah.
And what he does is that, so what that does is like, you then all of a sudden feel immediate closeness to him because now he's saying, I'm doing this for your own good.
Yeah, it's an abusive relationship.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a cult leader. That's the difference.
And he's also so charismatic. These people, and all these people, they're so charismatic that you desperately want them to like you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, concerning the subject of Jack's pursuits, Parsons was bucking Aleister Crowley's advice during this time period. See, Crowley thought of magic as a discipline designed to help in mental and mystical development, essentially a very complicated thought exercise, while Jack Parsons believed that it was actually real. And Parsons wasn't the only one around the parsonage who believed in the practical power of magic. Around this time, Parsons began engaging in serious magical rituals outside of the OTO with the help of his childhood friend and fellow rocket scientist, Ed Foreman.
Ed Foreman. Yeah, I like to masturbate into a cup. It's for the goddess Babylon.
It's very close to Red Foreman, which is the dad on That 70s Show.
Oh, that's true. Wow. Wow. I wonder if there's actual a relationship. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
It's
a made-up character.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting. But Aleister Crowley actually has a definition for magic. He says that it's the science and art of causing change to occur in conformity with will, right? So he has this idea, and he calls himself a scientist of magic. But that's what we were saying at the very end, that Xenu was inside you all along. What he, at the very end of the Thelemic, like, from what I understand, obviously I'm no longer in the business of trying to fully decipher these works, because it does take, you need a teacher and you need to decide that they're real or not. You have to do all that fucking shit. But Crowley, the very, very end of his life, and at the very end of all of his magical works, he comes back full circle to be basically where it's just like, and here's a reminder. All of this is about personal development. None of it, like, he's not saying that it's not quote unquote real, but the whole point is to not even worry about, you're supposed to get past that.
Doesn't matter if it's real or not. All that matters is that it works.
It works for you. It's supposed to help develop your personality, blah, blah, blah. It's a God replacement system. It's like, well, human beings are kind of evolved to believe in some kind of God or whatever we think that we wanted. And then when we killed God in the science age, there's now a hole, right? And so this is one of those things that could fill the hole for some people.
That's why I have my new electrolyte bracelet, and it's really good. It's helped me.
It's really important.
Yes, it's powerful. It was all very expensive.
But Jack Parsons, this is where his naivete comes in.
Yeah,
because he started getting really obsessed with results. Now this is because
he's a real scientist.
Yes, yeah. And this is where we call him the ultimate student, is because in his mind he's like, now he's doing that thing where it's like, none of you are going far enough. He's now been doing magic for 7 years. And he's like, but he's talking to somebody like Aleister Crowley, who's technically been doing all of this quote unquote work for 40 years, his whole life. And he's telling him, he's like, you're wrong. It's like when you pick up reason why I never learned to like play guitar, because all I ever wanted to do was like play Freebird. Like I wanted to play like metal riffs.
Yeah,
and then
I
pick it up and like try to learn the chords. And I was like, this is dumb. I hate doing this. Right. And then Jack Parsons wants to skip all that and go right to, I want to do something cool with it.
Guitar Hero.
Well, yeah.
You can play a Guitar Hero like Holden McNeely did for probably 10 hours a day for a year and a half.
Close to 5 years. Yeah. We were there playing there until 5 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
And he actually knows how to play guitar.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so.
50-50.
He can plug out a song.
We're going 50-50.
Well, that's the thing. Like I said, like Ed Foreman, he's also in the same boat as Jack Parsons when it comes to actually getting results, seeing shit, making things happen. So years later, when Ed was an old man, his daughter reportedly asked him about the numerous volumes of occult literature on her father's shelves. And all he said was, quote,
it's all real. It all works. Don't touch it.
What the fuck you talking about, man? You talking about like the toaster or something? Like what, they're books, right?
Don't ever look at your father again.
All right, it's fine.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like that thing of like, you know, where he's taking off his glasses and he's rubbing the bridge of his nose. He's just like, it's all real. It all works. Don't touch it. He seriously believes in it because he had an actual experience that backed up that statement about magic being real. And it ended up being the last time he dabbled in ritual magic. The story goes that Ed and Jack performed a summoning of some sort because they just did this shit to see what would happen.
All day long.
Yeah.
He was fully obsessed with it. And so they were always doing weird rituals. Yeah.
That's what I do every time I get Grubhub or Uber Eats. It's a summoning.
It's a summoning to me.
Yes. Yes.
And when Ed got home after the ritual, he heard the piercing wail of a banshee.
A banshee.
Oh.
That's an orgasmic woman. Yes.
Then he looked out his window and he saw a banshee.
A banshee. Again, that's an orgasmic woman, Henry. Oh, closer, closer. Yeah.
No one else in the house, however, could see or hear the banshee. It was like Ed's personal banshee, following him around, screaming at him.
All right, real Crash Bandicoot moment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
For years afterward, it was said that Ed Foreman would shudder from time to time because he could still hear the wail of the banshee as clear as one might hear a garbage truck out front.
Ed, I don't mean to be insulting, but could it be the garbage truck?
Maybe. Maybe there's a banshee in the garbage truck. Mm.
Is that horny, horny garbage man?
I love the sexy movers.
But no one ever heard the banshee's wail except Ed Foreman.
Wow. What does a banshee's wail sound like truly? Oh, okay.
We can actually put in some kind of sound effect.
I mean, we don't know what a banshee is.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's very high-pitched, extremely high-pitched.
Have you met an extremely mad Irish wife?
Okay, I got it. You got it. I love that 1930s material.
Fly from your grave.
Many businesses are hiring for holiday jobs, and some of those job titles might not be what you expect. Think turkey catcher, bilingual Santa Claus, and reindeer wrangler. Yes, these are actual jobs on ZipRecruiter. If ZipRecruiter can fill these roles, what roles can't they fill? If you're hiring, you should go to ZipRecruiter.com/LPOTL. ZipRecruiter makes it easy to send a personal invite to candidates who seem perfect for your job, so they're more likely to apply. ZipRecruiter also has an easy-to-use dashboard with a complete suite of tools that let you filter, review, and rate your candidates all from one place. We love using ZipRecruiter. It's helped us find fantastic employees that make our whole network run. Discover hiring joy with ZipRecruiter. 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/LPOTL. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/LPOTL. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And from what old school OTO member Jane Wolfe said about the Parsons rituals, he didn't particularly care what he evoked or what he summoned, just so long as he got results that he could see, hear, and feel.
And the kind of way to describe this a little bit, because this is very esoteric, but in rituals, some people believe that if you're doing shit that counts, that's quote unquote working, is that you'll get stuff like phantom knocks. Weird things, sounds like bells to hear, sounds of bells chiming, doors opening and closing. I mean, a lot of it's got to do with foundation. You know what I mean? Right. The house is a lot of times it's slanted and it's difficult. But then,
but of course,
if you're in a supremely slanted house, it's probably easier to do magic anyway because you're on a diagonal mindset.
Like Marcus's first home in Brooklyn there, which made you feel drunk just by walking in, which was great because it took 5 beers off your price tag. Well, you only need 5 beers, feel like you had 10. But yes, phantom knocks, and indeed, LRH did get big old titties, didn't he?
That's good.
Thank knockers.
You. Yes, honestly, he wasn't even that fat towards the end. He looked comfortable.
He was dying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, whether or not any of this is quote-unquote real, that's up for debate.
Sure.
But it felt real enough to the other OTO members living in the parsonage that they would perform banishing rituals as almost a part of the house cleaning. It's something to put on the fucking chore wheel.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's lest Jack leave anything untoward on our side of the spiritual plane.
Well, Thank you for that.
I just recently heard Sarah Lyons in Somewhere in the Sky describe this as a group of people doing magic in an area and like doing a lot of meditative work. There's something, I believe it's called a morbid circle. I forget what the actual term was. I might be incorrect in this. There seems to be some form of either, whether it's, again, if it's real or not, I don't know, but a societal effect that the more people are in a room doing like meditative, like magical shit over a period of time, you can kind of change the space, like you change the vibe.
Yeah, and Sarah Lyons actually has a new book out. It's called How to Study Magic. I read it right before I moved to LA. It's pretty solid.
Yeah.
If you're listening to these magic episodes and you're like, I have no idea what the fuck they're talking about, but I want to know more, check out Sarah's book. It's pretty solid. It's very solid.
It's a really good plug. And I would also say, like, again, read Liber 4. It is very, like, he wrote Liber 4. Aleister Crowley wrote Liber 4 as a reaction to people saying that his works are unreadable because they are unreadable. Yes. And so he wrote that. And so it's like, again, if you just want to understand what it is, it's there.
And also revolutionary witchcraft gets a little political. Sarah was in my documentary, Hail Yourself America. She helped me when I ran for office.
She got
me 0.1 of the 1.6% of votes I got.
That's all it takes.
She got the witch vote.
There we go.
one woman
in Williamsburg.
They vote with their brooms.
Yeah.
Well, since Jack was so willy-nilly with what he summoned, and he was very willy-nilly with what the consequences might be, Ed Foreman dropped out as his magical partner after the whole banshee incident.
Well, the whole house seemed to be violently haunted. They said that the upstairs, they were like, while he was doing all of this shit, they said that they wouldn't even go on the third floor anymore because that was where his like temple room was. And again, it does. Is it haunted or is your landlord upstairs naked but for robes all day long going, there's like incense burning, fucking classical music blaring and shit. Like, it does set a tone.
It sounds like a haunting to me.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, because Ed Foreman was out, that meant that the only person around who would still play with Jack Parsons was L. Ron Hubbard.
Okay.
I'm here, baby.
Soon after Foreman dropped out, Parsons and Hubbard began working together on a summon that, if successful, would usher in a new era for humanity.
Ooh, the Korean War?
Yes.
Starting in March of 1945, Parsons and Hubbard embarked on a series of magical rites of Jack's own creation that came to be known as the Babylon Working, which was designed to manifest the biblical character of Babylon, the scarlet woman riding the great beast in the Book of Revelation. Interestingly, this working had an element of chaos magic. Instead of taking inspiration from grimoires or even some of the newer OTO writings, Parsons based much of the Babylon working on an Aleister Crowley novel called Moonchild, which somewhat annoyed Aleister Crowley.
Well, because technically, so if you're reading all of Crowley's works, you're supposed to examine all of his shit for all of the various levels of meaning that it can have, right? According to you, if you believe in magical theory. And so Moonchild technically is a piece of fiction that Crowley wrote as like a parody of various magicians in his field. And it talked about this idea of a magical baby being created and like these two white magicians and black magicians like fighting over the baby. And there is stuff in there, but mostly it was a work of fiction and it was never really supposed to be a working. And so Jack Parsons, again, in all of his like childlike enthusiasm to do the biggest, baddest magical working and to show Daddy Crowley that he's a big bad magician and he could do it well and he's the best at it. Yeah. He was like, I'm gonna make the Moonchild. And Crowley was like, you might as well like make a version of the movie Moonfall be real. You know what I mean? Like, now we're scared of the moon. Like, that style being like, no, it was supposed to be funny.
Sounds like Rosemary's Baby.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar.
Now, contrary to popular belief, and what I actually thought before we started getting into this series, Jack Parsons was not trying to bring about the end times with this working.
Nah, dude. He was trying to fucking end the age of Horus.
Yeah, and yeah, he was trying to birth a female messiah, the eponymous Moonchild, a symbol of religious freedom, female emancipation, and sexual liberation. In other words, Jack Parsons was just trying to make the world a little bit groovier.
Somebody's got to try to make that Gaia's pussy wet, man.
Okay.
But there is a bit of like, again, did he mean to create an actual physical child? I don't know. And neither does any, from the readings, it's also not specifically very clear. And there's also the idea is like, was it supposed to be creating a spirit that would inhabit a living person and that living person would actually be a physical incarnation of Babylon?
That's more how I saw it.
There's some of that, but there's also another version of it. Are they just opening a hole? Are they just doing a thing, letting the energy of Babylon into this world to destroy the man-led age of Horus? And like, they're supposed to do that. I don't
know. All I know is I got to go invest in Theranos. That's all I know.
You see, this is where it works.
Yep.
Now, it was thought when Parsons first started the Babylon working that he was actually trying to summon a demon to destroy L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh.
Because by this point, Hubbard had all but stolen Sarah away from Jack completely.
Right.
Oh, yeah. She was. They were all like, again, it was doing the thing where she's sitting on his lap all day playing with his captain's hat.
Uh-huh.
And you just have to sit and watch him in his big pants in your living room. Because he's not paying rent.
No. Parsons owns this house.
Yeah.
Yeah. I might have kicked him out at that point then.
And he had a hold on him.
Yeah. But that's the thing. If you kick him out, then you've destroyed everything that you've preached, everything that you worked for.
Nice thing is you just like forget about it. Just go back.
Again, this is Jack Parsons. He's truly a bleeding heart.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. Parsons, he actually didn't begin the Babylon working with L. Ron Hubbard. He only brought L. Ron Hubbard in later. But Parsons was never petty with his magic. Instead, Parsons believed that he would never be able to bring Babylon into existence unless he first summoned a flesh and blood elemental to help him. Henry, could you please explain an elemental, or at least as far as how Jack Parsons approached the concept of an elemental?
So now you're curious about my thoughts. Yeah. You guys are both now curious about what I think.
I've asked you three or four questions already this episode.
I picture Jimmy or Timmy from South Park.
You're not too far. But so elementals are physical proof of the spiritual world, according to them, right? His idea of like Jack Parsons was obsessed with this idea of like summoning something that would then physically show up. But according to the Crowley works, it's all everything that you are summoning and quote unquote seeing in your mind. What you learn at the very end is that it's just parts of your brain. It's all like, but Parsons like, no, I'm going to make it show up. So the first half of the Babylon working was him doing this like arcane thing to allow the peace that would arrive that would allow him to complete the entire working that he thought in his mind was supposed to be a physical representation. Nowadays, you know, like elementals are similar to sylphs. Like nowadays, you'd say like back in the day, they used to see fairies. Now, like the most common version of a sylph is a UFO. Mm. Like we'd see that. Like that's
a sylph, huh? Like, I never heard that before.
A sylph.
A sylph.
Yeah, it's like a simp, but you'd give up. You give money to yourself.
Okay.
But you see UFOs. To them, it was like that. He thought he'd see a thing that would like show up. Yeah. But again, he didn't know what was going to happen. He was just kind of starting this process to like begin this like moonchild ritual. And, you know, he didn't know what was going to happen. But then it did. I guess it did work out.
Yeah.
All right.
And so he started doing summoning rituals.
Okay.
And when he did it, he would put a specific artist on his gramophone. Fernando, if you would. Set the mood, please.
Because this is important about ritual. So you get to set sounds, smells,
absolutely.
No farts.
No, none at all.
No, you really have to create a vibe, man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. This is how they get us scared on the news.
Yeah. Yeah, you see? Set an atmosphere, set a tone.
Now, from what other members of the OTO later said, when Jack was summoning, weird and disturbing noises could be heard coming from his room. Wails that sounded like someone was dying. Or was at the very least, deathly ill.
Oh, fuck! Uh-oh. Yikes.
Thinking Jack was in trouble, they opened the door and saw the figure of Jack Parsons in a dimly lit, smoky room, dressed in a black robe, rhythmically chanting what sounded like gibberish in the center of a pentagram that had been drawn in front of an altar.
Hom Nam Shivai! Hom Nam Shivai! Hom Nam Shivai! Hom Nam Shivai!
Now, while Jack's chant sounded like gibberish to the uninitiated, he was actually speaking Enochian, the so-called language of the angels. Or he was at the very least pretending to do so.
Well, Enochian is written down. Is it real? No.
What is language? Is language real?
Exactly.
Powerful.
Now, Enochian is often defended by those in the magical community because it has its own grammar and syntax, despite never being attached to any known civilization or society.
Like Klingon.
That's the thing about it. That's what I've said in the past. Klingon has its own grammar and syntax. Elvish has its own grammar and syntax.
It's not
doesn't make it real.
It's not that difficult. But John Dee, again, we're finding ourselves in a little bit of what Kissel's old cone of who does the more work, the writer or the guy who thinks of the words.
The writer.
Sure.
Not the writer, the scribe.
The scribe.
The scribe. That was
scribe
when you had a quill.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Very difficult.
But this is, so John Dee, again, he set up all of this. If you want to know where Enochian came from, the Enochian language was transmuted by an ancient magician. I think he was in the 1200s. I forgot what years it was.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a scribe that also turned out to be a bit of an unscrupulous character where John Dee would do the work. He would like project and think about it in his mind, do all the kind of magical thing. And then the other guy would write down all the stuff that John Dee was thinking that he saw.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then that's where they came out with this Enochian language is a way to decipher the ethers.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Let's bring the music back. Parsons would switch between Enochian and English while doing these rituals, using a consecrated dagger to trace a five-pointed star in the air while he recited an ancient invocation.
Dear thou me, for I am the angel of Paphro Osor Ronophris. This is thy true name, handed down to the prophets of Israel.
Hey, Jack, the rent is due.
Dear thou me, for I am...
Jack. Hey, the landlord's here. Hey, hey, Jack.
Well, it sounds like a very powerful ritual.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
Well, it's also kind of funny because it's, you do these rituals in other religions and it's just like, it just, when you set it out of context of like a big fancy house, people look stupid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he was upstairs. He was alone. He has the his name it's is his on the house. Fucking lease.
Mm-hmm. While invoking the angel, Jack Parsons would also, of course, be vigorously masturbating.
Oh, that's the difference. That's the difference.
Well, there is actually, he only vigorously masturbated on certain parts of the ritual.
Well, yes, he wasn't doing it for 2 hours.
Did he have to be hard the whole time, though?
Well, no, that's actually just, to be hard the whole time in a room of other magicians is truly just, I believe, like, it's like the fifth or sixth degree in the OTO. It's like one of those that you have to do. But what he did was he does this, like, it's an hours long process. Where he goes, he opens up the circle, he screams about, like, you know, like, he says all these, like, ancient tomes, he does the hand signals, and then he calls it, I'm just trying to find the term for it, I believe it's called particulate, is what
that
he generates.
Familiar.
Yes,
yeah.
It is he generates it because that's what gets the goop.
Okay.
Well, he's trying to fertilize. It's just, you're like a mother patiently listening to to her sons about like a hobby that she has no idea, but she's really supportive.
Well, that's Henry good and Marcus, they go up and they masturbate up there and they do a lot of screaming, but they come down for their hot pockets and for their, you know what? They get their pizza rolls, I'll tell you that.
Well, he was trying to fertilize the magical tablets. Okay. You got to have cum if you want to fertilize the magical tablets.
Absolutely. That was, again, that was like, what's interesting at the time is like, that's the secrets of all secrets. And the guy who's sitting and watching all of this shit, none of this is supposed to be exposed to anybody outside of who was not an ordained member of any of this shit. And you just got LRH on the other side of the door being like, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, by that metric, the most ordained books we've ever had are a penthouse or a Playboy.
It's true. You got to invoke. Yeah. Invoke.
I wonder if anyone has ever jerked off to the articles. We'll think about it.
I actually picked up some really interesting issues at Penthouse. And,
I know. I remember
that. It's called Invocation of One with Material Basis on Talisman.
Okay.
I'm not going to masturbate to that John Hinckley article, although it is fascinating.
Yeah, they wouldn't let him perform his music.
No, I know, but you put a couple of boobies on him and I'm all about him.
Sure.
Well, once Parsons shot his load, he would perform a banishing rite, retracing everything he'd done in reverse. And by the end of each 2-hour-long ritual, Parsons would be physically and mentally exhausted, especially once he started using his own blood to fertilize the tablets instead of just whacking one out.
Well, you got to mix it up. That is real. Mm-hmm. Like, you're supposed to mix it up, and then certain invocations need blood and certain ones need cum.
Okay, do they ever need both?
Hey. Well, okay. Again, super top secret. That's a super top secret, like, at the very end, if you get to the 10th degree of the OTO, a woman's supposed to period into the cup, and then you come on top of the period, and then you drink that, and then, well, you have to first make it God. Like, you look at the cup with the stuff in it, and you go do a bunch of stuff that makes that thing God, and then you eat it. It's very, Kissel, it's great.
I love, this is a great English class. Yeah. That's awesome.
Now, part of the reason why we know so much about Parsons' solo summoning is because he recorded the results of every ritual just as a scientist records the results of an experiment.
That's from Crowley, the idea of you treat it like a science.
In the first ritual, for example, he noted that a violent windstorm followed its completion, which was, quote unquote, interesting, but not what he asked for.
But this is what we're talking about, the fact that he's desperate for results, which is one of those, that's like one of the big
rules.
So it got
windy.
Yes.
Yes. It got windy.
But really windy.
Super windy.
Super windy. And it never does that in California.
No.
There's never a thing called the Santa Ana winds. It doesn't happen.
Yeah. No, not without him jerking off naked upstairs in his house as another man has sex with a woman he loves.
But as he performed the ritual more and more, it seemed as if the phenomena became more pronounced and aggressive, and the summoned spirits allegedly began to interact with other people in the house, particularly L. Ron Hubbard.
Uh-oh.
On one of the days in which Parsons performed the ritual twice, the electricity mysteriously shut off after the attempted summoning. Reportedly, L. Ron Hubbard was in the kitchen at the time and was suddenly struck in the shoulder, which caused him to yelp.
Ow!
Whoa!
This brought Jack Parsons running into the room, and when he arrived, he supposedly saw a 7-foot-tall, brown and yellow light towering over L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, my God. And there was no lights on in the house.
No, there weren't.
Wow.
I guess there weren't. No. No, I don't know.
A light above L. Ron Hubbard, like he's taking the stage.
Yep.
No, 7 foot tall, brown and yellow.
Brown and yellow.
It seemed to have an intelligence behind it.
Oh, okay.
Like the original Wolverine.
Cool.
What?
Yeah.
You remember those old costumes? Was it the new costume? The
brown and yellow was the second costume. The first costume was actually blue and yellow, and then he went to brown and yellow. Or actually, it wasn't even yellow in the 80s. It was brown and, I think, white.
Son, I just wish you'd get a job.
Yes, indeed. Wolverine, great character.
Well, somehow, though, Parsons knew just what to do when he saw the brown and yellow light. He grabbed a sword and performed a quick banishing ritual, burning sulfur and tobacco, following the apparition around the house while he drew pentagrams in the air with his sword until the figure dissipated.
That's fun.
These guys really believe this shit. Yeah. You, like, I guess that's why, like, when some people were like, oh, matching episodes are dumb. I understand. But if you just, like, think about it for a second and the fact that they're all living in this reality.
I love it.
I love it.
I love the idea of, like, just think about Jack Parsons just
hey down elemental, and L. Ron Hubbard like two fingers up his wife's pussy, just right. Like that guy just gets funnier and funnier.
Okay, a lot going on here.
But from the appearance that Hubbard had been attacked, Parsons took it to mean that Hubbard was especially magically sensitive and could be an ally in the summoning. So they put aside their personal grievances and attempted to bring about the Babylon working together. Once Hubbard started sitting in, the visions and figures appeared in greater number and clarity, and supposedly L. Ron Hubbard once subdued a summon that looked just like rival Wilfred Smith.
Oh.
He subdued it with throwing daggers.
Yep.
Whoa, no kidding.
He pinned it to the wall.
Whoa, I can't get out of here.
It's not a ghost. It's a ghost. I actually did not understand a ghost could be pinned by knives.
Can it be?
If they're magical knives.
Are they real knives or fake knives? Are they actual knives?
No, it's real. They said throwing daggers.
Okay, so those are tangible.
Yeah, and he learned how to do that like most fat guys who spend most of their time on the internet learn how to do that.
Throw them.
Yeah, you just throw them. Yeah. Throw them. Yeah.
Later, Parsons claimed to have heard a buzzing metallic voice crying, quote,
"Let me go free. Let me go free.
Get out of here.
Let me go free."
Oh, we are the world.
Yep. L. Ron Hubbard, again, yes and.
Yeah.
That's his whole thing about it. So he's just like, well, you must be great at magic. And LRH is like, yeah, I must be.
Okay.
And then they go and they're like, because he's like, all right, so your job is you write everything down. And then L. Ron Hubbard's like, I'm an excellent writer. Mm-hmm. And so he just doubles down. Whatever he's saying, he's just like, yeah, and there he is.
Mm-hmm.
We got to get him with a knife. Like, he's throwing knives at the wall. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, and if you just base how good a writer is on word count, L. Ron Hubbard is really incredible.
Him and Dickens.
Yes, indeed.
Now, after 2 weeks of rituals, Parsons and Hubbard traveled to the desert for more magical practice. And as they sat beneath a crossing of massive power lines, Parsons said that he felt a tension snap. He turned to Hubbard and simply said, "It is done."
Yeah,
uh-oh, I have cancer. I love the power lines.
This was an 11-day ritual. Yeah. So he did this every day for hours and hours, and that was like the first half of it. And at first, he's like, nothing happened.
And then what?
And he felt the tension, and they went on their little staycation out in the desert together.
And in what is at the very least one hell of a coincidence, when they return home to the parsonage, Jack's elemental had seemingly arrived in the form of a 23-year-old redhead from Belle Plaine, Iowa, named Marjorie Cameron.
Now, this is a woman that would have ruined my life if I had met her. She is exactly my type.
Oh, yeah.
She is
she breathing?
Well, she was tall, busty, redhead. And
why are you looking at me?
She was mysterious, man. No. Real mysterious.
Yeah.
Difficult.
Professional pain in the ass.
I say that, yes. Yeah. But also raconteur.
Yes.
Performance artist.
Destructive as a tornado.
I love her.
Sounds like an elemental.
Now, Marjorie, like a lot of people at the parsonage, she'd already lived an appropriately weird, witchy, and sexy life prior to showing up at Jack's doorstep. Marjorie had been so named by her mother's sister, who demanded that the child be named Marjorie because she believed it meant Pearl of God. And her request was honored only because Nell was dying of tuberculosis.
Most Marjories I've met are more of a blarb of God. You know what I mean?
Yeah, Marjorie, it's an interesting one. But it's
Marge.
Yeah, big Marge.
I do like it. But this all came from the book. We have a whole other book on Marjorie Cameron called The Wormwood Star that's like, her life was fascinating.
Well, yeah, it is fascinating.
I think that she's an interesting character, but it's very difficult.
I mean, she was in a bunch of, like, she was in Kenneth Anger movies. She worked in that scene. You know, she's a very, like, she's a legendary artist. She's a great artist. She's just an artist. And so, many artists are, but she's like a special extra pain in the ass.
She's magical in the fact that she's just never once had to work a real job ever. Artist. And that's the artist. That is the artist lament. Because like when Jack Parsons finally died, it was her final statement was, "I don't know how to make a living," which I think is the artist's lament.
Yeah. Well, Nell also predicted that Marjorie would be born with red hair and blue eyes, and that Marjorie would become a nun and take the veil as a daughter of Christ. And in this, she was correct in a somewhat sideways manner, because Marjorie's life would indeed be wrapped in the metaphysical until her death. Once Marjorie was born and her aunt Nell died, though, Marjorie was supposedly haunted by her dead relative because Marjorie was forced to sleep in Nell's old room.
That'll do it.
Yeah. And she became convinced that the well in her grandparents' backyard was a hole to hell.
That's
fun. Little girl in there, man. Girl in the well, dude. Watch out.
I hate her neighbor, man.
Remember fucking baby,
girl in the well, man.
Baby Jessica, dude. Baby Jessica, man.
Now, when Marjorie grew up and World War II broke out, she enlisted in the Navy as a wave. She was one of the many women who helped out during the war effort.
What's called like Women Active Volunteer
Something.
Every
eggs.
Time. Every
All the time.
But that is also where her life of intrigue began. It was rumored that Marjorie Cameron was drafted by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to work as a honey trap.
Ooh, yeah. That's the most fun Joint Chiefs, dude. That's the fucking weed chiefs, dude.
They constantly insinuated in the Warm Word Star that she like got everywhere because everyone was like, she's fucking hot. And I do actually kind of think that that was probably true of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah, to be a honeypot, sure.
Well, supposedly she lured the head of a Nazi propaganda group based in America to a hotel room in Washington and used her feminine wiles to elicit information.
Played with his balls.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to get a German to become aroused.
Is it?
I don't know. They're a weird bunch.
They are.
Eventually, though, Marjorie went AWOL and her parents moved to Pasadena. There, her father got a job, very coincidentally, at Jack Parsons' former company, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory.
It's weird.
Yeah.
That's weird.
And this fact is coincidental because Marjorie did not meet Jack through her father. Instead, she was out in Pasadena visiting her parents when she ran into a guy that she used to sleep with in D.C., and it just so happened that this former fuck buddy lived at the parsonage.
They always end up there.
I didn't know when I was fucking you, I was making a whole... I didn't know you were taking evidence, man. I was in the federal penitentiary for 10 years because of you, man.
I'd do it all again.
I thought the Germans had some good ideas, man.
We are literally going to need to do an entire episode about the intelligence community's connections to all these various magic groups because they all have tangential connections to a lot of cryptic covert ops that I kind of want to... There's a way to go through all... We will do an episode on it.
There's a connection, and I think it might be a personality connection. I think probably more than anything else, I think that they tend to both...
They're professional liars, so
they both tend
to
attract the same types of people.
Yeah.
Well, we talked about it a little bit with MK Ultra.
A little bit.
Live from your grave.
Now, while it's often made up to sound as if Marjorie Cameron simply appeared on Jack's doorstep after the first part of the Babylon working, it was not quite as cinematic as all that.
Well, Jack Parsons definitely sold a story.
Yeah.
As if she arrived from a storm. He said he was home and then he heard a thunder crash and Marjorie appeared at the door like wet in a blanket just being like, I don't know where I came from.
Well, you got to shut that door right away, dude.
No, very much so.
He'll be like, you better figure out where you came from.
But that was the story he told Marjorie to tell people for years because he wanted to kind of create the magical thing. And she's like, no, Jack. She would dispute it in front of people. And it was kind of fun fight that must have been.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really fun.
Yeah. Well, she'd come by the parsonage previously, and recognizing another powerful mind primed for magic, Jack had tried convincing her to join the Agape Lodge. And as it just so happened, Marjorie returned looking for Jack on the very night he returned from the desert, just after he'd told Hubbard that the first part of the working was done. Almost immediately, Jack and Cameron began performing sex magic rituals, and for the next 2 weeks, they barely left Jack's room.
Well, isn't that just something?
Well, she says that when she came in and she saw him, he did that thing. It was like old school, where he like gave her a wink. She was like, okay. And then they walked away, right? Yeah, I'm using
it
now.
I hate it. No, you've been using it.
I've
been using it.
Is that Cardi B?
Yeah, I don't know who it was. But that was inside
of me. I like Cardi B.
But then when she came back, she was like, she just fell right into it. She was like, she made her hot as fuck. And so they went and they started fucking. The thing is, there's some word about whether or not she knew she was doing magic while they were having sex. because there were some things that said that she didn't know that they were doing magic sex rituals, and that she was like, oh, that's why he was so animated. Literally, because the whole time he's going, like fucking her and doing hand motions and stuff. And so she just thought he was incredible.
I don't know about that. So they weren't so sex. What was that? Red Hot Chili Pepper sex magic.
Blood sugar sex magic.
She was more hot dog and the wet chocolate. What was the name of that Limp Bizkit one?
Chocolate starfish and the wet hot dog?
Yeah, something
How
like that.
How dare you? She was more of a Limp Bizkit. I would not call her that.
And he was Red Hot Chili Pepper.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. All right, okay. All right.
That's all I'm saying. Just
to help him learn.
Sure.
I'll accept.
I'm learning. Sometimes this is the interesting thing about time. They always say, oh, the future means progress. We're all going to come together. Things will be more of a wonderful utopia, but that's not happening.
No.
And then sometimes they say, oh, the more you learn, the more you'll know. But then sometimes you learn and you're dumber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, we've been doing this for years.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I still can't tell you my niece's birthday.
Yeah.
But I can really go through a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Honestly, no one can do that.
No, I'm not liking the future. Yesterday, I was...
You created it.
No,
you created it.
But that's the thing.
Killing dogs?
Hey, no. That's not it at all. I was using fucking Google Maps yesterday.
Yeah?
And it fucking gave me an ad for Taco Bell in the middle of my directions. Take a right after Taco Bell.
They do that.
Well, that's what they do. And also, they have something going on with Hardee's or Carl's Jr., wherever you are. There's something going on.
They're being like, you know, it's always like, yeah, use the police station next to the Hardee's. You're like, what?
Well, Jack Parsons described Marjorie Cameron as fiery and subtle, determined and obstinate, sincere and perverse.
Ooh.
In other words, the perfect elemental for summoning a messiah. And according to Jack's writings, the moment she proved herself was when, just a few weeks into their relationship, she spotted a silver cigar-shaped UFO in the sky.
That's cool.
Which would be a common occurrence in Marjorie Cameron's life.
Well, he said that he wrote down in his magical journal that the elemental would reveal itself after it's seen a sign. And so when she described this UFO, and he's like, look what I wrote down. And he saw a thing, and it was just like a circle with a triangle in it. And it's like, see?
Wow.
And he's like, all right.
Then I take it back. She's not Limp Bizkit at all. She's Ace of Base.
Sure. Nazi sympathizers.
What?
Huh.
Okay, we're going to move on.
Fernando knows.
No,
it's true.
No.
It is true.
Ace of Base?
Yes.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
You'll see. Look it up.
You can look up anything and prove yourself right.
And so, with his elemental at his side and L. Ron Hubbard as his magical partner, Jack Parsons began the second part of the Babylon working, the so-called invocation of the biblical whore of Babylon.
Oh, my.
Using the Enochian language once again, Jack and L. Ron set up a series of magical evocations to summon the goddess, while essentially cosplaying as the men who discovered the language of the angels.
It was done on purpose.
Yeah.
Ooh, that would be a great porno. Becky Does Babylon.
Ooh, I bet that's probably...
Oh, have
you ever seen The Devil and Miss Jones?
Yeah,
that's a classic.
It's
of
good.
Of course, yeah. The devil loved being in there. But what's Babylon? Remember that Keith Raniere is like Albany, New York.
Oh, yeah. The new Babylon.
I think we have to move on from the idea of creating Babylon. Call it something fucking different.
I believe that Babylon was supposed to originally be a symbolic representation of the quote-unquote hedonistic end of times of Rome.
Epstein Island?
Right? Like, yeah, but from Roman times. It was supposed to be that. It literally was supposed to be. Everyone was mad that Rome had become this giant, hedonistic, swollen, contemporary place, and they had lost touch with the natural energies that made them real. You know,
wiped their asses with the same sponge.
We now know that they were different in a way that we can't handle anymore.
Man,
we're not like
day.
That no more.
I'd love to just be at the Coliseum just one fucking day. Free but wine.
There are also some people saying whether or not it was real. We don't know.
Well, Jack inhabited the role of Elizabethan magus John Dee, while L. Ron Hubbard played Dee's scribe, Edward Kelly.
These
nuts.
He was kind of crazy. But these guys, you never know with these guys. But he said the reason why he used Enochian, because it was the only formula that had produced results for him.
Yeah. Well, this was actually an appropriate match for both men. You know, L. Ron Hubbard playing Edward Kelly and Jack Parsons playing John Dee.
It's perfect.
Because Edward Kelly, way back when he and John Dee were practicing Enochian magic in the court of Queen Elizabeth, Edward Kelly had actually convinced John Dee that the angels had told him they should swap wives.
Yeah, man.
The angels told him that.
These angels
Why would the angels care?
Crazy.
Out of all the things, I feel like they would care more about a touchdown being scored in an NFL game.
No, I thing.
Why do the angels want everyone to be unhappy?
As you'll discover, it's when later on, Jack Parsons would write a biblical, he'd write a magical bibliography, which he'd say, like, describing why he was the way he was magically and where it all came from. And in his mind, it was stuff like the reason why he had to fuck Betty was because the relationship with a tinge of incest like gave him sort of the transgressional activity that gave him like extra magical juice. And so this kind of is a long-standing thing within magical thought of like, y'all should do something fucked up, because is it shakes it up from the inside. But really, most of the time, it's the guy who wants to fuck your wife, and he's got the quill, and he's doing it all, and he's telling you, I want to fuck your wife, but he's saying the angels are telling him to do it.
You can't have a tinge of incest.
Yeah, well,
because a tinge, it's like a shit.
Well, stepmoms, fucking your stepmom is a tinge.
No, but it's like a shit, it's like shit in a punch bowl. It's like mostly not shit. But now it's just like that shit in a punch bowl. So I don't know.
Well, it's a tinge of incest.
No, but tinge is still not stepmom.
That's what they're saying, tinge of incest.
It's in the reason why he said it's a tinge of incest is because he left his wife for her sister.
Yes.
So there's a tinge.
So he fucked two pussies, same family.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
It's cross also, incest.
Tinge of incest, also a fantastic new Nirvana cover band.
And so, with Hubbard in tow, the goal of the Babylon Working came into sharper focus. They wanted to unleash the licentious spirit of Babylon upon the world, thereby destroying the stranglehold Christianity had on common attitudes towards sexuality.
They wanted a whole world to be funky, man.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This would thereby set in motion the revolutionary Aeon of the Great Beast. Not the Aeon of Horus. Which one? What comes after the Aeon of Horus?
It's a Babylon.
Babylon.
That's, the idea, is that Babylon's supposed to replace the Horus energy that is all men. Mm. Oh, you men.
Oh, yuck.
Now, even though Hubbard was all in with the rituals, I don't think he was ever a member of the OTO, was he? Yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, all of this shows deeply because Jack Parsons is now, this is him abandoning his track on the OTO. Mm-hmm. This is him walking away from it because he's not supposed to see any of this shit.
Yeah.
All of this was only supposed to be people that were quote unquote vetted. Again, the difference between Scientology and the OTO is that Scientology is trying to actively get people in, where the OTO is trying to create all these things to kick people out. They're trying to have you not be in. It's supposed to be secret.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Well, LRH, he's just hanging around. He's absorbing everything he can. And as such, most of the other OTO members had no idea what Parsons was even attempting, because the Babylon Working was, as I said, something that was created by Parsons himself based on an Aleister Crowley novel. As far as Crowley went during all this, he oscillated between intrigue and denigration. Sometimes he was curious as to whether or not they'd pull it off, and sometimes he'd call them both morons for even trying. In a letter to one OTO member, he wrote, quote,
"Apparently Parsons or Hubbard or somebody is producing a moon child. I get fairly frantic when I contemplate the idiocy of these louts."
Oh, wow. So he says he doesn't like that one bit.
I feel a little bit of the waning powers of a man in his twilight years, far away
addicted
from what
to
is
heroin.
Not,
yeah, way addicted.
Very addicted to heroin. The Agape Lounge is the current, in this time period, is
Agape
the last.
Agape Lodge.
Agape Lounge. I keep on a lounge.
Well, lounge, that's just, it's fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
But he's so far away from the action.
Yeah.
The OTO is the Agape Lodge is the last functioning OTO building in the entire, in the whole world, because his fell apart. His abbey fell apart. And so I think there's a little bit of jealousy, a little bit of like, they don't get it. They don't get all of the shit because he constantly laments that I wish I had more time with Jack Parsons for him to understand the final thing is that it's all made. It's all like in your head, but he's kind of just like, what are these guys doing? They're trying to show me up.
Yeah.
They're trying to take the mantle of the most powerful magician in the world.
Move it forward.
Yeah. And Crowley is also like, he's a little bit pissed off because Jack Parsons is sort of biting on his style just a little bit.
A little bit.
You know, because, you know, Crowley, of course, he wrote the Book of Law after a spirit named Awas supposedly dictated every word following a ritual done in an Egyptian pyramid. So Parsons figured he's going to do pretty much the same thing to kickstart the Babylon Working. He goes out to the desert and he writes something that he claimed was dictated by a spirit, a volume called The Book of Babylon.
But the problem with The Book of Babylon is that, to be honest, it's way more straightforward than the Book of the Law. There's the poetry in the Book of the Law is why it's decipherable. Like, that's kind of the point of it. It's like why you're supposed to dig in, because it's just nothing but allusions to all of the writings that Crowley has done that has come through this kind of like, his way of separating himself from his consciousness by like channeling something. But it's like, that's the one thing about the Book of Babylon. It's a little on the nose.
Yeah. Well, I think they would agree with me then that being the scribe is indeed more difficult.
I feel in this world where we're at, the scribe is having a harder time.
Absolutely. Because the other one's just an angel.
Yeah. It also makes little sense, the Book of Babylon. Right. You know, from what author George Pendle wrote.
Book of Babylon on.
I mean, yeah.
I'm insulted.
If the New York Post reviewed Books of Magic, then yeah, that's what they'd say.
You know, more like, book of, you're a fucking piece of shit.
Whoa.
Whoa, crazy.
Wow, what a review.
Very clever.
Well, soul coherent threads are repeated references to flames and madness, which is super cool.
Yeah.
But here's an excerpt. I mean, it sounds good, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Yes. It is even I, Babylon, and I shall be free. Thou fool, be thou also free of sentimentality. Am I thy village queen, and thou a sophomore, and that thou shouldest have thy nose in my buttocks?
Whoa.
It is I, Babylon, you fools. My time has come, and this my book that my Ada prepares is the Book of Babylon.
Sounds like a fucking tweet.
He does say a lot of, like, if you do read it, it kind of does kind of make sense, but it's just kind of saying the same thing over and over again. They're going to bring in a new age of power and cleanse the world with a purifying flame. But really,
that's always good when they call for a mass cleansing.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, flame of frenzy, the frenzy flame.
Oh, that'll be great.
That it does, what is weird, though, is that of all the people who wrote a bunch about bursting into flames, it was the dude that did end up bursting into flames. Like, he exploded. Himself, so.
Yeah, but after two more months of rituals and desert trips, L. Ron Hubbard, he had enough.
Well, he's a sea man.
It's a lot of work. He's not sitting there and making shit up.
He's not a desert boy.
I know.
You know.
Reportedly, he'd often be, quote, left pale and sweaty from his exertions.
I'm soaked right now, just doing the podcast. So I get it.
Yeah, and Hubbard finally, quote unquote, had a vision that told him that his work with Parsons was at an end.
There you go. Perfect.
Hey, listen. Hey, just so you know, your wife's great.
Yeah.
Second of all.
I know.
Just
you,
got
I can
a
tell.
Beep, 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 beep. Whoa, just got a message. Gonna have to quit all this shit.
All right.
And so with Hubbard out, Parsons similarly declared that his working was a success.
I did
okay.
it.
Okay.
Yeah. Babylon, he said, would be born in 9 months. And the new aeon would follow. Or eon. The new eon would follow.
Where?
Everywhere, dog.
Everywhere?
No, where was it born?
No, where's it going to be?
Everywhere,
the new eon? No, the new eon is the new eon. It's like that's like everything. Asking where is 1996?
Yeah. Where is it in the past?
In my mind.
Linear, though. In my time soul. Is not. So at the same time, 1996 is now.
No, it's layered on top of us, isn't it? Or beneath us.
Oh, ho. Well, this meant that Jack's magical work was done.
Right.
And with the Babylon working finished, Jack Parsons decided it was time to return to science.
Well,
he had to go get a job again.
Okay.
The truth is that he was kind of heartbroken at the end of the Babylon working. It's like as he was doing it, he was expecting all these results. And then so the latter half of the Babylon working was him Marjorie Cameron was also now a part of it with L. Ron on the side drawing things that he saw on the side of it. Like they're doing all these rituals. And at the end of it, nothing really happened because it's interesting is because this is why I'm against the concept of they were trying to create a physical baby because Marjorie Cameron did get impregnated during the process of all these magical rituals.
Mm.
But then they got an abortion because both Marjorie Cameron and Jack Parsons were like, no kids.
Yeah.
There's no kids in this world. We're not bringing our kids into this, which is really interesting for a bunch of people trying to create a mystical child.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's one way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Marjorie Cameron did break that that rule later.
Yes, of course, but it was after she was not with Jack Parsons anymore.
That's right. Well, Jack Parsons wrote a letter to all of the members of the OTO saying he was selling the parsonage.
Wow.
He was very sad, but this is what I'm saying. He was heartbroken that nothing, like, after the last one, he had this idea that it would, like, burst forth.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things would change.
Well, he wanted it too much.
Well, it's subtler energies.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, everyone had to move out by June 1st.
Gotcha. That's the real stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, I know we're talking about elementals and stuff, but the movers are coming.
Yes, they are.
Well, Jack handed the reins of the now homeless Agape Lodge to another member and began plans to get his own explosives company off the ground using profits from the sale of his mansion.
Oh, great.
Yeah. But while everyone at this point could have just gone their separate ways with a cordial, nice working with you.
Seen all your dicks? Glad to see what all of your cum faces look like?
Absolutely.
Love Prokofiev? Love all this shit, man? So, but unfortunately, we're just going to have, this is the parting of the waters.
Yeah. Okay. But that wasn't L. Ron Hubbard's style.
Oh, nah, dog. Fucking you let me in, bro.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, figuring that he'd learned everything he could from Jack Parsons, and seeing as how he'd also stolen Sarah Northrop away, Hubbard decided to go for Jack's money.
Oh, yeah. Because,
well,
again,
don't do that.
LRH was light at the time.
Yeah.
And he was in between jobs. The U.S. government was not really wanting to give him the money that he asked for his conjunctivitis. Do you remember he had, like, terminal conjunctivitis?
Yeah, pink eye, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's when he was trying to get $600 a month from the U.S. government because he was like, I am a writer and I need that eye to look at the periods. You know what I mean? Like, all this kind of shit.
Get a milky eye, yeah.
It's very funny. But
oh, you ever hung out with someone with a milky eye?
Oh, yeah.
Ugh, man.
It's oh, yeah. Fine. Like a guy with that watery eye?
No, if you got a milky eye, that's all right.
It's tough. It's tough.
But while... I don't know what you have against people with milky eyes.
I don't want to talk about
it. I mean, it's bad when it's chocolate milk.
Whoa.
Well, see, Parsons had gotten a pretty penny from selling the parsonage. About 350 grand in today's money, which would have been more than enough to get a good explosives company off the ground. Hubbard, however, told Parsons that he could use that money to make even more money.
Well, more money on top of money?
Yeah, listen here.
And you can get an even better explosives company.
It's listen, like you're the talking top? About yeah. money.
Uh-huh.
What, you know what I like more than money?
What's that?
More money.
More money. Okay, and
I'm
going
to double it. Just give it to me. I'm going down to Bally's. I am going to flip this whole thing. I got my numbers. I always play my numbers.
Yeah. Oh, Bally's. I thought you were talking about the gym.
No, never.
Oh, okay. The casino. Great.
All Parsons needed to do, hand over his life savings.
Just hand over the life savings. It's perfect.
Things be reasonable about this. Yeah. And you hand me your life savings. Again, you can trust me. Look at my captain's hat. I'm a captain of a ship that I don't yet have.
Okay.
Well, Hubbard's plan, you see, he's going to go down to Miami. He's going to buy 3 yachts.
Boom, done. Boom, got it. Yachts, you're sitting there. Got it, okay?
Okay, got a bunch of yachts.
He's going to hire some crews.
Easy to go. He's fine. Sailors are fucking horny to get away from their families. Whip them up.
They're sailors.
Sail the yacht south.
Got to.
Take it through the Panama Canal.
Now, isn't that like fucking, right? Because we're going through a little canal. Mention it.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Macro
you sail
intercourse.
It back up north to California.
Yeah.
And you flip the yachts.
That's all we do. We turn those yachts literally upside down. We got upside down boats. It's magic.
Well, there's no yachts you could buy in California. I don't understand that.
I have to go to Florida.
Oh, you have to
understand
go to
is that the
sounds
yachts,
like you just want to sail.
A yacht is a yacht is a yacht, right?
Mm.
Yachts. What does that stand for? Y-U-A-I-U-R. Caught the hate. I gotta go to Florida.
Let's just okay.
say, you're paying attention to me. We need to just be giving me the money.
Well, absolutely. Here's all my money then.
Now, almost everyone at the OTO thought that this plan was, in a word, stupid.
Yeah. What?
Yeah.
No, stupid. No, you don't give, there's no way
sounds
you don't
stupid.
Give the man who is the most full of shit in a mansion filled with practicing magicians a bunch of money. That's weird.
And that's not least because Parsons was still financially supporting the Agape Lodge, even if he wasn't providing them with housing. But even though he was warned, Parsons handed over his entire life savings to L. Ron Hubbard, making Jack Parsons actually the first person to ever hand his life savings over to L. Ron Hubbard. The first of many.
Wow. Well, that's great. Did he get an
all
acting
it takes
career?
His one. All it takes is one.
He does all of his own stunts.
Now, Hubbard did indeed head down to Florida with Sarah. And he did indeed buy 3 yachts.
Okay. I have the bones. Look at that.
I mean, that's more than I thought he was going to be doing with it.
Yeah.
Well, it was 1 yacht and 2 smaller boats. The Diane, that was the yacht. And the 2 smaller boats, that was the Harpoon and the Blue Water 2.
Yeah, sure, I said 3 yachts, but 1 yacht is good. And I got 3 boats.
Okay, I mean, it's actually, for such a liar, it's kind of close to the truth, almost.
But once Parsons was out of L. Ron Hubbard's immediate sphere of influence, he slowly began to realize that maybe he'd been had.
I think all of us have been in that position where you're in your hotel room and you're like, I don't think she's coming back. I have a feeling it's 500. That's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Yeah.
Huh.
But all it took was a phone call from Hubbard, and Parsons' confidence in their partnership would return.
He's got the boats.
Yeah, he's got the boats.
That's the hardest part.
Yeah, it is.
Finally, though, the other members of the OTO tattled on Parsons to Crowley. And when Crowley wrote a letter calling Jack an idiot for getting swindled out of the OTO's funding, Parsons traveled down to Florida to take revenge and maybe get his money back. Once he arrived, he placed a temporary injunction and a restraining order that was supposed to keep Hubbard and Sarah from leaving America or from selling the yachts.
I mean, it's L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah, no, dude, because what does he know, man?
Speaking of magical power, a restraining order. No, I've written it down.
Yeah, no, it does nothing. But guess what, man? Guess what L. Ron knows deep down inside? Because we all clams, right?
Mm-hmm.
You just go out to the water because that's where man's truly free.
Kind of, in the center
of the ocean.
Kind of, but also not really.
Yeah. And by the time Parsons finally heard from Hubbard, L. Ron and Sarah had already set sail.
Can't get me, bitch. Can't get me.
So, supposedly, Parsons drew a magic circle on the floor of his motel room.
Oh.
He stepped into it and performed an invocation to Bartzabel, the spirit of Mars. Now, this could be a complete coincidence. Although you may notice by this point, the coincidences are piling pretty fucking hot.
That's what I was talking about with the Sarah Lyons, like, aspect of it. If a bunch of people doing a bunch of weird, wiggity shit all at once, like, sometimes it does create, like these...
Like boating.
like boating. It creates a series of synchronicity.
Yeah. But at the same moment that Parsons performed his invocation, a sudden squall off the coast of Florida ripped the sails off Hubbard's yacht, and Hubbard was forced back to shore.
Not much of a swimmer.
Yeah. No, I can't imagine.
Parsons was waiting for them, and he took them to court for damages.
Oh, that magical court system.
Yes. Well, because the problem is that they were going to go back and forth, right? So they wanted to sue him for the boats, wanted to get the money back.
Right.
But then he was just like, what about the little thing called a tinge of incest?
Yeah.
Because he wanted to go to the newspapers and immediately was like, I'll tell them all that you fucked your wife's sister, which is still not incest.
But. Well, the thing is it's more than just you fucked your wife's sister. It's more like we're going to go tell them, we're going to go tell the cops that you fucked your wife's sister when she was just a smidge underage.
Oh.
Yeah. So she could have sent Parsons to jail.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And so Parsons had no choice but to take whatever was given. And he walked away with a little less than $50,000 in today's money, which sounds a lot, but it ain't $350,000.
No, it's not.
A month later, Sarah Northrup became Sarah Hubbard.
Oh.
Although unbeknownst to her, Hubbard was still married to his first wife, Polly Grubb, when they said their vows.
Can't get enough of him.
Grubby Hubbard.
Yeah. And to hear how that story ends, go check out our series on L. Ron Hubbard once you're done with this episode.
Yeah.
Parsons, meanwhile, went home to his elemental, Marjorie Cameron. They got married, too.
Oh, nice.
And Parsons began calling her Candida, which quickly became Candy, because she hated the name Marjorie due to its associations to her ghost aunt.
Yeah, so he went with Candida?
Yeah, Candida.
Candida. Yeah, like he's a child in a convenience store desperately trying to come up with an imaginary friend's name.
Candida.
And he sees a Snickers bar.
Okay. It comes from an opera. I do think that there was something magical, but Marjorie Cameron would go as also Cameron.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh.
Cameron and Parsons soon moved into the coach house behind the parsonage. And Parsons, perhaps humiliated by his loss to Hubbard, he soon resigned from the OTO.
L. Ron Hubbard drank his milkshake. He drank his magical milkshake. He showed up. He sapped everything fucking out of him, and he left them for nothing. The Babylon working, nothing happened.
No.
And now they're just sitting, and he is understanding what's happened. His fortune is decimated.
Oh.
He's left his career in his fucking record-breaking world in rocket science. He left all that. Now he's got Marjorie Cameron, who is his fun elemental, now is his wife.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The parsonage was demolished soon after.
Literally bulldozed.
Like a Dahmer apartment building? Yes.
And supposedly, when OTO members surveyed the site, they found a copy of Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law conspicuously placed amidst the rubble.
Ooh.
Now, concerning L. Ron Hubbard and the OTO, the time he spent with Parsons would remain somewhat of a secret until an article was released in 1969 detailing their partnership, not too long after the Church of Scientology was established.
Yes.
In true Hubbard form, though, the church issued a fantastical lie with a hint of truth.
Oh, hint. Hint Just of truth.
Just a tinge of truth.
It's a tinge of truth. They said that L. Ron Hubbard had actually been sent to the parsonage by the Navy to break up a black magic cult and rescue a girl.
The man had terminal conjunctivitis, according to his paperwork.
Why would the Navy do that? It seems like more of a land.
No.
Would it be like an army thing? Or?
All land is solid water.
Yeah.
Didn't you see that?
Yeah, and Pasadena's like close to water.
Yeah, dude. It's like it's like 3 hours away from the beach.
Yeah. Kind of deserty, I thought.
No. It's 3 hours to the ocean.
It's dry heat. Yeah.
It's closer than Denver.
See?
Yeah, but Denver, I actually think gets more water just with snowfall.
Oh, that's all I have to do.
Great.
Well, concerning the tinge of truth, Hubbard had destroyed the Agape Lodge for all intents and purposes.
Very much so.
And he had whisked Sarah Northrop away, even if he did later write a letter to Jack Parsons offering Sarah back.
Listen to me, Jack. Is this one of those things where you get something on sale and you can't return? It's a final purchase. If you want her back,
right?
She's totally available to be yours again.
But like, did she want to go back to Jack?
No.
Well, then that also matters.
Yes, she was fucked.
It's like trying to return Chucky, the doll.
Very much so.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't think he wants to be returned.
I think it's returning any human. Like the idea that you can return a human to somebody else.
Only human. Yeah, it's my human. Yeah. Take her back.
Well, Chucky is kind of human, isn't he?
Specifically not.
Well,
kind of.
It depends.
Specifically
not. Is a human a soul? Or
exactly.
Is a human...
Ask L. Ron Hubbard.
The vessel just happens to be a doll.
I watched this interview that he set up to ask, like, all him questions about Scientology. And LRH, they ask him, what is man? And he's just like, okay, here we go. We see this little statue right here? No, this is man, right? You see all this area around here. You see all this invisible area around here? No, you fucking don't. Because that's where I caught you on your first lie. You can't see it. I just said it's invisible. That's his mind. And then here, by here, you know, you see this other invisible area. Do you see this down by your feet?
I don't.
You see, you're learning. That's his soul. Man is but this. Man, body, soul, mind. Clams? Like, it is just he says nothing. He says absolutely nothing. He cannot define anything.
Do you think you can get me a small role on Three's Company?
I'm 10 years ago.
Fantastic.
But nevertheless, no matter how fucking stupid it was, while Jack Parsons struggled to find work over the next few years, L. Ron Hubbard took what he learned from Jack Parsons and published the foundation of Scientology, Dianetics. And this annoyed Marjorie Cameron and Jack Parsons.
Well, these are also people who maybe didn't fully grok the history of magical societies
and secret societies. Good word. Yeah. Way to go.
Grok.
I'm making this just, every vagina is going to be so parched.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So he did steal. But again, the history of secret societies is that each one stole from something. The Rosicrucians technically stole from the Knights Templar, if you do believe this. So the idea that the Knights Templar had secret teachings. There's also more of the idea that they had hand signals and things that were secret, so they knew who was Knights Templar and who was not, so they could figure out who do they transfer the treasures from the Crusades to safely, right? That's one thing. The Rosicrucians applied esoteric meaning to the weird, like, symbols that they all did. And then the Freemasons stole that from the Rosicrucians, and then the OTO stole the structure from the Freemasons, and then so it's just everybody stealing. So these L. Ron Hubbard looked at the grades, and he understood, I'm going to steal that. I'm going to understand, like, the bridge I stole. He also steals the Xenu reveal, because that's the eighth degree, guess what, eat your own cum now, like,
whoa,
the OTO reveal that's supposed to be the secrets of secrets, and then he stole the final secret, which is that you show somebody something that they have spent so much time and energy involving themselves in, and then all of a sudden now it's like, oh, Xenu, or now I have to eat my own cum, and it's too late for them because of the sunken time dependency, and now they're bought into your system forever.
Yeah.
It's like sampling music, kind of.
But I also realize why it's called tech in Scientology is because with all of this magical realism shit, I know we're at the end of this episode, and I need to get this out of my system.
Yeah,
but it's like the idea of Aleister Crowley calling himself a scientist of the mind is that he thinks that you're doing all of these things through trial and error, and they believe that God, quote-unquote, works in mysterious ways. Everybody who's a part of these esoteric societies, they believe very heavily in God, but they wanted to figure out how, quote-unquote, God literally works. Like, how does God have his creative powers, blah, blah, blah. So we are going to do these, like, rituals to copy the this is the science of God, right? You're fascinated.
That'll work.
I'm glad you're here yeah. together. But then L. Ron Hubbard, in truly Crowleyan fashion, strips that level of mystery away again, and he's just straight up calling it technology. All of these actions you're doing within Scientology are quote-unquote technology that is allowing you to be a more purer version of man, which he doesn't even know what that is.
Fantastic. It'll help you get a role on Young Sheldon, maybe.
Not anymore, man. You can't even
oh, that show's still on.
No, but Scientology, they don't have their fingers as deep into the acting world as they once did.
It's still there.
No, honestly, they're completely... It is over. It's sad. You can't even do it anymore.
Yeah, it's sad. Well, the thing is that, you know, Marjorie and Jack, they believe that Dianetics, it was a watered-down ripoff of Thelema. It just wasn't cool
Dianetics
anymore.
Makes no sense.
Yeah, and Marjorie claimed that she actually caught L. Ron Hubbard dumpster diving behind Jack's house, trying
get out of here. Ron, hey, Ron, we know it's you.
No. Yeah, he's trying to retrieve papers that Jack had thrown out. Just anything that he can steal. Now, at their cores, Thelema and Scientology, they're pretty damn similar. As it was pointed out by author George Pendle, both religions preach that man is an immortal spiritual being. Both say that his capabilities are unlimited, and both say that his spiritual salvation depends on his attainment of a quote-unquote brotherhood with the universe.
But one really costs a lot more money.
Yeah.
Right. Than the other one. Yeah.
The difference is that the OTO is really hard to understand, it's extremely involved, and it's immediately weird and uncomfortable. Scientology, however, begins passively, begins with an audit, begins with you answering questions, begins with someone interested in you, and it's dressed in modernity. It's dressed as in this is the new thing that we're doing. This we're using science. We're using the modern world. We're not using all this other old stuff. All this old stuff that's just
this ain't
fucking
your
it's
this
fucking
ain't
up
your,
our Ingrams.
It's not your daddy's magical rituals.
Your grandpa's. Yeah. Did you guys ever do that in Union Square? There would be auditors. Did you guys ever do it? I was always like busy, had to go to work.
Yeah.
I just watch them.
Yeah, it was always at the subway station at 42nd and 8th. That was where I always saw the auditors. They're not there anymore. I kind of miss them.
Union Square, they always had one down there, too. But I just never...
But the OTO and the Golden Dawn and stuff, it was way more kind of like book club than anything else. It was really going through... It was about esoteric knowledge, blah, blah, blah. But in Scientology, he did the thing where he was like, it's all practical and it costs money. Mm-hmm. So, like, he turned it into a business, which is where he was both correct and evil.
Yeah. Now, one does wonder about a world in which Aleister Crowley attained influence on the level of L. Ron Hubbard. It's interesting to think about. What if Thelema was as ubiquitous as Scientology is today?
I think there'd be a lot more, like sex industrial music.
Yeah.
Like, what was the name? What was it? Not Sigur Rós.
No.
What was that, like, sexy, like cocaine? Portishead.
I think Portishead
would have made the national anthem.
Trip hop. Yeah. But as it went instead, that boat trip that Hubbard took with Sarah after he scammed Jack Parsons, that was the beginning of Scientology. And it was also the beginning of the end for Jack Parsons. And that is where we'll pick back up for the conclusion to our series.
The reason why we're doing a fourth episode is because so much more came out in our research about Marjorie Cameron that we want to include. And then also really digging into the conspiracy theories of Jack Parsons' death. I mean, there is a lot of shit it's very strange, obviously. Many of these things may not appear as they seem. We'll talk about the Saturn death cult, which I'm really excited for. And also, did Jack Parsons make aliens?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, and of course, this entire thing, don't forget, he dies very young. So that's kind of interesting.
I'm in my Jack Parsons year, 38.
Yeah. Or was he just a sweaty guy? That's also a possibility.
It is.
All right, everyone. Well, thank you all so much for listening. Thanks for listening to all the shows on the network.
So good. We got Marcus back in the studio fucking permanently.
Yeah.
He's here. West Coast, baby.
Oh, yeah. I made the jump. Yeah. I made the jump. I'm over.
I'm here.
He's
looking good. He's tan. I think you're just covered in poop.
I'm not.
No, he looks the exact same as far as complexion. He's still inside all the time.
Yeah, I've been here 5 days.
Yeah, you'll see. We'll get you there. We're going to get you one of those hoverboards. We're going to get you. You're going to be a TikTok kid. Uh-huh. You're going to say bussin' a lot.
Bussin'.
Yeah. No one's saying bussin'.
No, he's saying.
No, no one is saying.
He's going to say mid. You're going to call things mid.
Mid.
What does that mean?
It means.
You're not even talking. That's not even what cool
kids
say.
Does that mean mediocre?
Yes.
Means but average.
I'll just say mediocre.
No, you'll say other sorts of stuff. You're going to say no cap.
No cap.
No cap.
I can't decipher that
means
one.
You're not. I'm not lying.
No cap.
No cap. But what cap?
Cap is your realm of honesty.
I don't know. all right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to, I guess we saw a bunch of people saying, oh, how many hours you've listened to the network. Thanks for that.
It's fucking crazy. It means a lot, man. I'm glad you guys put that shit out there. We'll be back next week. We're going to just keep doing this shit until we're in the grave.
Yeah.
And Ace of Base, more Nazi sympathizers. I'm looking right.
Okay. Hail yourselves, everyone.
Right, Fernando? Hail Satan.
You can't just defame Ace of Base.
It's right here. You can look at it.
Hail Gein. I think they were Nazi sympathizers.
They're saying Ace of Base is too, because they're saying no, we weren't. And some people, yes, they were.
Yeah, because if they say no, they weren't, they weren't.
Well, I don't know.
Magustalations, everybody.
Hail me.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors. You can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.